Must be coincidence, nothing more.
You're probably right, Alfred.
Bane smiled sweetly and closed his eyes. The smile remained on his lips. He was inwardly enjoying some private joke. Alfred, nursing his knee, decided that, as usual, he had made a mush of things. I gave Bane a clue to the truth, and against all express orders to the contrary, I took a being of another race into the heart and the brain and brought her back out again. But does it matter any more? Does it really matter? He couldn't help himself. His gaze went to Haplow, who was settling down for the night. Alfred knew the truth now, yet he resisted it. He told himself it was coincidence. The boy had not met every person in the world. There might be many whose past lives were not visible to him through the medium of his clairvoyance. The Chamberlain watched Haplow lie down, saw him give the dog a pat, saw the dog take up a protective position at the man's side. I have to find out. I must know for certain. Then my mind will be at rest. I can laugh at my fears, or prepare to face them. No, stop thinking like that. Beneath the bandages, you will find sores, as he said. Alfred waited. Limbeck and Hugh returned to their beds, Hugh casting a glance in Alfred's direction. The Chamberlain pretended to sleep. The prince had drifted off, seemingly, but it might be well to make sure. Limbeck lay awake, staring up into the top of the vat, worrying, afraid, repeating to himself all his resolutions. Hugh leaned back against the vat's side. Taking out his pipe, he stuck it between his teeth and gazed moodily at nothing. Alfred did not have much time. He propped himself on one elbow, keeping his shoulders hunched, his hand held close to his body, and faced Limbeck. Raising his index and middle fingers, Alfred drew a sigil in the air. Whispering the rune, he drew it again. Limbeck's eyelids lowered, opened, lowered, quivered, and finally shut. The Geg's breathing became even and regular. Turning slightly, keeping his movements smooth and stealthy, Alfred faced the assassin and drew the same sigil. Hugh's head dropped. The pipe slipped from between his teeth and fell into his lap. Alfred's gaze turned to Bane, and he made the same sign. If the child hadn't been asleep before this, he was now. Then, facing Haplow, Alfred drew the rune and whispered the same words, only now with more concentration, more force. The dog, of course, was most important, but if Alfred's suspicions were right about the animal, all would be well. He forced himself to wait patiently a few more moments, letting the magical enchantment draw everyone down into deep sleep. No one moved. All was quiet. Slowly and cautiously, Alfred crept to his feet. The spell was powerful. He might have run round the vat shouting and screaming, blowing horns and beating drums, and not a person there would have so much as blinked an eye. But his own irrational fears held him back, halted his steps. He sneaked forward, moving easily, without a limp, for he had been shamming the pain in his knee. But as slowly as he moved, the pain might have been real, the injury truly debilitating. His heart pulsed in his throat. Spots burst and danced in his eyes, obscuring his vision. He forced himself on. The dog was asleep, its eyes closed, or he never would have succeeded in creeping up on its master. Not daring to breathe, fighting suffocating spasms in his chest, Alfred dropped to his knees beside the slumbering Haplow. He reached out a hand that shook so he could hardly guide it to where it must go, and he stopped and would have said a prayer had there been a god around to hear it. As it was, there was only himself. He shoved aside the bandage that was wound tightly around Haplow's hand. There were, as he had suspected, the runes. Tears stung Alfred's eyes, blinding him. It took all his strength of will to draw the bandage back over the tattooed flesh so that the man would not notice it had been disturbed. Barely able to see where he was going, Alfred stumbled back to his blanket and hurled himself down. It seemed that he did not stop falling when his body touched the floor, but that he continued to fall and went spiraling down into a dark well of nameless horror. Chapter 38. Deep Sky Above the Maelstrom. The captain of the elven ship, Carfa Shon, was a member of the royal family. Footnote. Carfa Shon, meaning in elven, at harmony with the elements. End of footnote. Not a very important member, but a member nonetheless, a fact of which he himself was extraordinarily conscious, and expected all others around him to be likewise. There was, however, one small matter of his royal blood that it was never wise to bring up, and this was an unfortunate relationship to Prince Rishon, the leader of the rebellion among the elves. In the halcyon days of yore, the captain had been wont to state modestly that he was nothing less than a fifth cousin of the dashing young and handsome elven prince. Now, following Rishon's disgrace, Captain Zankorel assured people that he was nothing more than a fifth cousin, and that was stretching a cousin or two. According to the manner and custom of all elven royalty, be they rich or poor, Captain Zankorel served his people by working hard and energetically during his life. and, again in the manner and custom of those of royal lineage, he expected to continue serving them at the time of his death. The lords and ladies of the royal family are not allowed to slip peacefully into oblivion at their deaths. Their souls are captured before they can flutter away to spend days in eternal spring meadows. The royal souls are then held in stasis by the elven wizards, who draw upon the soul's energy to work their magic. It is necessary, therefore, that wizards constantly attend the members of the royal family, ready at any time, day or night, in peace or during a raging battle, to grab up souls should death occur. Footnote. It is thought by some that the Order of the Kyr monks may have developed among humans as a corrupt form of the elven shadows. The Kyr monks, being a secret and closed organization, refused to discuss their origins. Legend has it, however, that they were founded by a group of human wizards who were endeavoring to discover the secret of soul capture. The wizards failed to achieve their goal, but the order they founded remained. Ordinary humans, those not possessing magical talents, were allowed to enter, and over the years the monks gradually turned from the attempt to cheat death to a worship of it. End of footnote. Wizards designated for such duty have a formal title, Wisham, by which they are referred to in polite society. Generally, however, they are known as Gyr, a word whose ancient meaning is vulture. The Gyr follow the royal elves from childhood to old age, never leaving them. A Gyr comes to the baby at his birth, watches his first steps, travels with him during the years of his schooling, sits beside the bed, even the bridal bed, every night, and attends him in the hour of his death. Elven wizards who accept this duty that to the elves has become sacred are carefully trained. They are encouraged to develop a close personal relationship with those over whom their wings spread a dark shadow. A Gyr is not allowed to marry, and thus the charge becomes his or her entire life, taking the place of husband, wife, and child. Since the Gyr are older than their charges, generally being in their 20s when they accept responsibility for infants, they frequently assume the additional roles of mentor and confidant. Many deep and abiding friendships grow between shadow and shadowed. In such instances, the Gyr often does not long outlive his charge, but delivers the soul to the cathedral of the Albedo, and then creeps away himself to die of grief. And thus, those of the royal family live from birth on with the constant reminder of their mortality hovering at their shoulders. They have come to be proud of the Gyr. The black-robed wizards mark royal status and symbolize to the elves that their leaders serve not only in life, but also after death. The presence of the Gyr has the additional effect of increasing royal power. It is hard to refuse the elven king anything he wants with that dark-robed figure standing always at his side. If the members of the royal family, particularly the younger members, are somewhat wild and foolhardy and live life with a devil-may-care attitude, it is understandable. Royal parties are often chaotic affairs. The wine flows freely, and there is a frantic, hysterical edge to the merriment. A glittering, gaily dressed elf maiden dances and drinks and lacks for nothing that will give her joy. But look where she will, she must see the Gyr standing back to the wall, the Gyr's gaze never leaving the one whose life, and most important, death, is in the Gyr's trust. The captain of the elven watership had his attendant Gyr, and it must be admitted that there were those aboard who wished the captain's Gyr godspeed in his work. The majority of those serving the captain expressing, quietly, the opinion that the captain's soul would be far more valuable to the elven kingdom if it was no longer attached to the captain's body. Tall, slender, and handsome, Captain Zancarel had a great personal regard for himself, and none at all for those who had the distinct misfortune not to be of high rank, not to be of royal birth, and, in short, not to be him. Captain?
Lieutenant?
This was always spoken with a slight sneer. We are entering the maelstrom.
Thank you, Lieutenant, but I am not blind, nor am I as stupid as perhaps was your last late captain. Having seen the storm clouds, I was able to deduce almost instantly that we were in a storm. If you like, you may go pass the word around to the rest of the crew, who may perhaps not have noticed.
The lieutenant stiffened. His fair-skinned face flushed a delicate crimson. May I respectfully remind the captain that it is my duty by law to inform him that we have entered dangerous skies?
You may remind him, if you like, but I wouldn't, for he finds you to be teetering on the edge of insubordination, returned the captain, gazing out the portals of the dragon ship, a spyglass to his eye. Now go below and take charge of the slaves. That is one duty, at least, you are fit for.
These last words were not spoken aloud, but by the captain's tone they were implied. The lieutenant and everyone else on the bridge heard them quite clearly.
Very good, sir, responded Lieutenant Botherin.
The crimson had drained from his face, leaving him livid with suppressed anger. None of the other crew members dared catch the lieutenant's eye. It was absolutely unheard of for the second-in-command to be sent down to the galley during a descent. The captain himself always took this hazardous duty, for control of the wings was essential to the ship's safety. It was a dangerous place to be during a descent. Their former captain had lost his life down there. But a good captain placed the safety of ship and crew above his own, and the Elven crew, seeing their lieutenant descend into the galley, their captain remaining at ease up top, could not forbear exchanging dark looks. The dragon ship dipped down into the storm. The winds began to buffet it about. Lightning flared, partially blinding them. Thunder roared, nearly deafening them. Down below, the human galley slaves, wearing the body harnesses that connected them by cables to the wings, fought and wrestled to keep the ship upright and flying through the storm. The wings had been pulled in as far as possible to lessen the magic in order for them to descend. But the wings could not be drawn in completely, or else the magic would cease to work completely, and they would plummet down out of control to crash upon Drevlin below. A delicate balance had to be maintained, therefore. Not a difficult task in fair, clear weather, but extremely difficult in the midst of a raging storm.
"Where's the captain?" demanded the overseer.
"I'm taking over down here," answered the lieutenant. The overseer took one look at the lieutenant's pale, tense face, the clenched jaw and tightly drawn lips, and understood.
"It probably ain't proper to say this, sir, but I'm glad you're here and he ain't."
"No, it is not proper to say that, overseer," replied the lieutenant, taking up his position in the front of the galley. The overseer wisely said nothing more. He and the ship's wizard, whose job it was to maintain the magic, glanced at each other. The wizard shrugged slightly. The overseer shook his head. Then both went about their business, which was critical enough to demand their full and complete attention. Up above, Captain Zancarel stood spread-legged, braced upon the heaving deck, staring through his spyglass down into the swirling mass of black clouds. His gear sat on a deck chair beside him. The wizard, green with sickness and terror, clung for dear life to anything he could get his hands on.
"There we shum. I believe I can see the lift alofts. Just a glimpse in the eye of those swirling clouds," he offered the spyglass. "Do you want to take a look?"
"May the souls of your ancestors forbid," said the wizard, shuddering.
It was bad enough he had to travel in this frail and fragile contraption of skin and wood and magic without having a look at where he was going.
"What was that?"
The wizard reared up his head in alarm, his sharply pointed beardless chin quivering. A crash had sounded from below. The ship listed suddenly, throwing the captain off his feet.
"Damn that Botherin," Zancarel swore. "I'll have him brought up on charges."
"If he's still alive," gasped the pale-faced wizard.
"He better hope for his sake he isn't," snarled the captain, picking himself up.
Swift glances flashed about the crew, and one rash young elf actually opened his mouth to speak, but was nudged in the ribs by a fellow crewman. The midshipman swallowed his mutinous words. For a terrifying instant, the ship seemed to be out of control, and at the mercy of the swirling wind. It plunged down sickeningly, was caught by a gust, and nearly flipped over. An updraft swept it high, then dropped it again. The captain screamed curses and contradictory orders in the direction of the galley, but took care never to leave the safety of the bridge. The gear crouched on the deck and seemed, by the expression on his face, to wish he had gone into another line of work. At last, the ship righted itself and sailed into the heart of the maelstrom, where it was peaceful and calm, and the sun shone, making the swirling clouds around it that much blacker and more threatening by contrast. Down below, on Drevlin, the lift alofts winked brightly in the sunshine. Having been purposefully built by the Mangers to be always directly in the eye of the ever-raging storm, the lift alofts were the one place on the continent where the Geggs could look up and see the sparkling firmament and feel the warmth of the sun. Small wonder that to the Geggs this was a sacred and holy place, made even holier by the monthly descent of the Welves. After a brief interval, during which breath came easier and color returned to pale faces, the lieutenant made his appearance on the bridge. The rash young midshipman actually had the temerity to let out a cheer, which brought a baleful look from the captain, letting the young elf know that he wasn't likely to be a midshipman much longer.
"Well, what havoc have you wreaked down there besides nearly killing us all?" demanded the captain.
Blood trickled down the lieutenant's face. His fair hair was clotted and matted with red, and his cheeks were ashen, his eyes dark with pain.
"One of the cables snapped, sir. The right wing slid out. We have jury-rigged a new cable now, sir, and all is under control."
Not a word said about being slammed down onto the deck, about standing side by side with a human slave, both fighting desperately to drag the wing back in and save all their lives. No words were needed. The experienced crew knew of the life-and-death struggle that had been waged below their feet. Perhaps the captain knew, too, despite the fact that he had never previously commanded a ship, or perhaps he saw it reflected in the faces of his crew. He did not launch into a tirade against the lieutenant's incompetence, but said only, Were any of the beasts killed? Footnote. Beasts, a term used by elves to denote humans. End of footnote. The lieutenant's face darkened.
One human is very seriously injured, sir. The slave whose cable snapped. He was dragged off his feet and hurled into the hull. The cable wrapped around him, nearly cutting him in two before we could free him.
But he's not dead? The captain raised a finely plucked eyebrow.
No, sir. The ship's wizard is treating him now.
Nonsense, waste of time. Toss him overboard. There's plenty more where he came from.
Yes, sir,
said the lieutenant, his eyes fixed on a point somewhere to the left of his captain's shoulder. Once again, the almond eyes of the elven crew slid glances at each other. In all honesty, it must be admitted that none of them had any love for their human slaves. There was a certain amount of grudging respect for the humans, however, not to mention the fact that the crew perversely decided to like anyone their captain didn't. Everyone on the bridge, including Zancarel himself, knew that the lieutenant had no intention of carrying out that order. The ship was nearing its point of rendezvous with the lifeline. Captain Zancarel did not have time to make an issue of this now, nor could he really do so except to go below and personally see to it that his order was obeyed. To do that would lessen his dignity, however, and he might get blood on his uniform. That will be all, Lieutenant. Return to your duties, said the captain, and spyglass in hand, he turned to look out the portals, gazing upward to see if the water pipe was in sight. But he had neither forgotten nor forgiven the lieutenant. I'll have his head for this, muttered Zancarel to his gear, who merely nodded, closed his eyes, and thought about being violently ill. The water pipe was at last descried, descending from the sky, and the elven ship took up its position as guide and escort. The pipe was ancient, having been built by the Sartan when they first brought the survivors of the Sundering to Arianus, whose water was plentiful in the low realm, but lacking in the realms above. The pipe was made of metal that never rusted. The alloy remained a mystery to the elven alchemists, who had spent centuries trying to reproduce it. Operated by a gigantic mechanism, the pipe dropped down a shaft that ran through the continent of Aristogon. Once every month, automatically, the pipe descended through deep sky to the continent of Drevlin. Although the pipe was capable of lowering itself, an elven ship was necessary to guide the water pipe down to the lift-alofts, where it had to be connected to a huge waterspout. When the two were hooked up, the Kixiwinzi, receiving some sort of mysterious signal, automatically turned on the water. A combination of magical and mechanical forces sent the liquid shooting up the pipe. Up above, on Aristogon, elves guided the flow into vast holding tanks. Following the Sundering, elves and humans had dwelt in peace on Aristogon and the surrounding isles. Under the guidance of the Sartan, the races shared equally in the life-giving substance. But when the Sartan disappeared, their fond dream of peace shattered. The humans claimed the war was the fault of the elves, who had fallen increasingly under the control of a powerful faction of wizards. The elves claimed it was the fault of the humans, who were notoriously warlike and barbaric. The elves, with their longer lifespans, larger population, and knowledge of magical mechanics, had proved the stronger. They drove the humans from Aristogon, the mid-realm source for water. The humans, with the aid of the dragons, fought back, raiding elven towns and stealing water or attacking the elven waterships that ferried the precious liquid to neighboring elven-held isles. A watership such as the one flown by Captain Zancarel carried on board 8 huge casks made of rare oak, obtained from only the Sartan knew where, and bound by bands of steel. On an isle run, the ship held the water in these casks. On this trip, however, the casks were filled with the junk that the elves gave as payment to the Geggs. Footnote. Every month, all the rubbish accumulated throughout the elven lands is transported by tear-drawn carts to the harbor. Here, it is loaded on board the ship and sent down to reward the faithful, long-suffering Geggs, without whom those in the mid-realm would not long survive. End of footnote. The elves cared nothing about the Geggs. Humans were beasts. The Geggs were insects. Chapter 39. Wome Drevlin, Low Realm. The Sartan built the Kixiwinzi. No one knows why or how. Elven wizards did an intensive study on the machine years ago and came up with a lot of theories, but no answers. The Kixiwinzi had something to do with the world, but what? The pumping of water to the higher realms was important, certainly. But it was obvious to the wizards that such a feat could have been accomplished by a much smaller and less complicated, albeit less marvelous, magical machine. Of all the constructions of the Sartan, the lift-alofts were the most impressive, mysterious, and inexplicable. 9 gigantic arms made of brass and steel thrust up out of the coralite, some of them soaring several menka into the air. Atop each arm was an enormous hand whose thumb and fingers were made of gold with brass hinges at each of the joints and at the wrist. The hands were visible to the descending elven ships, and it was obvious to all who saw them that the wrists and fingers, which were large enough to have grasped one of the enormous waterships and held it in a golden palm, were movable. What were the hands designed to do? Had they done it? Would they do it still? It seemed unlikely. All but one of the hands drooped in limp stiffness like those of a corpse. The only hand that possessed any life belonged to an arm shorter than all the rest. It stood in a vast circle of arms surrounding an open area corresponding roughly in size to the circumference of the eye of the storm. The short arm was located near the waterspout. Its hand was spread flat, the fingers together, the palm facing upward, forming a perfect platform on which any so inclined could stand. The interior of the arm was hollow, with a shaft running up the center. A doorway at the base of the arm allowed entrance, and hundreds of stairs spiraling upward around the center shaft permitted those with long wind and strong legs to ascend to the top. Apart from the stairs, an ornately carved golden door led into the shaft within the arm, and the Geggs had a legend which told that any who entered this door would be whisked to the top with the speed and force of the water that shot up out of the geyser. Thus, the Gegg name for the contraptions, Liftaloft, though no Gegg in current memory had ever been known to dare open the golden door. Here on this arm, every month, the High Froman and the Head Clerk and such other Geggs deemed worthy gathered to greet the Wells and receive their payment for services rendered. All the Geggs of the city of Wome and those making pilgrimages from neighboring sectors in Drevlin ventured out into the raging storm to gather around the base of the arms, watching and waiting for the Mona, as it was known, to fall from heaven. Geggs were frequently injured during this ceremony, for there was no telling what might drop out of the barrels of the Welsh ships. An overstuffed velvet sofa with claw legs had once wiped out an entire family. But all the Geggs agreed it was worth the risk. This morning ceremony was particularly well attended, word having gone out among the news singers and over the squawky talk that Limbeck and his gods who weren't were going to be given to gods who were, the Wells. The High Froman, expecting trouble, was considerably disconcerted when there wasn't any. The crowd that hastened across the Coralite in a break during one of the storms was quiet and orderly. Too quiet, thought the High Froman, slogging through the puddles. Beside him marched the Head Clerk, his face a picture of self-righteous indignation. Behind him were the gods who weren't, taking this rather well, considering. They, too, were silent, even the troublemaker, Limbeck. At least he appeared subdued and grave, giving the High Froman the satisfaction of thinking that at last the rebellious youth had learned his lesson. The arms could just be seen through the break in the scudding clouds, the steel and brass gleaming in the sunlight that shone only on this one place in all of Drevlin. Haplo gazed at them in undisguised wonder. What in the name of creation are those? Bane, too, was staring at them, open-mouthed and wide-eyed. Briefly, Hugh explained what he knew of them, which was what he'd heard from the elves and amounted to almost nothing.
You understand now why it's so frustrating, said Limbeck, roused out of his worries, staring almost angrily at the lift aloft glistening on the horizon. I know that if we Geggs put our minds together and analyze the Kixie-Winsie, we could understand the why and the how, but they won't do it. They simply won't do it.
He irritably kicked a bit of loose coralite and sent it spinning across the ground. The dog, in high spirits, went chasing after it, leaping and bounding gleefully through the puddles and causing the coppers surrounding the prisoners to cast it wary, nervous glances.
A why is a dangerous thing, said Haplo. It challenges old, comfortable ways, forces people to think about what they do instead of just mindlessly doing it. No wonder your people are afraid of it.
I think the danger is not so much in asking the why, as in believing you have come up with the only answer,
said Alfred, seeming almost to be talking to himself. Haplo heard him and thought it a strange statement to come from a human, but then this Alfred was a strange human. The Chamberlain's gaze no longer darted to the patron's bandaged hands. Instead, he seemed to avoid looking at them, and to avoid looking at Haplo if at all possible. Alfred appeared to have aged during the night. Lines of anxiety had deepened, smudges of purple discolored the folds of puffy skin beneath his eyes. He obviously had not slept much, if at all. Not unusual, perhaps, for a man facing a battle for his life in the morning. Haplo tugged reflexively at the bandages, making certain the telltale sigla tattooed on his flesh were covered. But he was forced to wonder, as he did so, why it now seemed suddenly an empty, wasted gesture.
Don't worry, Limbeck, shouted Bane, forgetting that they were walking out of range of the thumping and bumping of the great machine. When we get to my father, the Mysteriarch, he'll have all the answers.
Hugh didn't know what the kid said, but he saw Limbeck wince and look around fearfully at the guards,
And so the guard stares suspiciously at the prince and his companions. Obviously, His Highness had said something he shouldn't. Where the hell was Alfred? He was supposed to be watching the kid. Turning, he thumped Alfred in the arm, and when the man looked up, Hugh gestured toward Bane. The Chamberlain blinked at Hugh as if wondering for a moment who he was, then understood. Hurrying forward, slipping and stumbling, his feet going in directions one would not have thought humanly possible, Alfred reached Bane's side, and to divert the boy's attention, began answering His Highness's questions about the steel arms. Unfortunately, Alfred's mind was intent on last night's horrendous discovery, not on what he was saying. Bane was intent on making a discovery of his own, and using the Chamberlain's unthinking answers, he was drawing very near it. Jara and the Wups marched behind the coppers, who marched behind the prisoners. Hidden beneath cloaks and shawls and long flowing beards were thunderers, jingers, a smattering of toots, and here and there a wheezy wail. Footnote. Known to humans as bagpipes. End of footnote. At a meeting of the Wups, called hurriedly and in secret late last night, Jara had taught the song. Being a musical race, the news singers had been keeping the gags in form for centuries, the Wups learned quickly and easily. They took it home and sang it to wives, children, and trustworthy neighbors who also picked it up. No one was quite certain why they were singing this particular song. Jara had been rather vague on this point, being uncertain herself. Rumor had it that this was the way Welves and humans fought. They sang and tooted and jingled at each other. When the Welves were defeated, and they could be defeated since they weren't immortal, they would be forced to grant the Geggs more treasure. Jara, when she heard this rumor spreading among the Wups, didn't deny it. It was, after all, sort of the truth. Marching along toward the lofts, the Wups appeared so eager and excited that Jara was certain the coppers must be able to see their plans gleaming brightly in the flashing eyes and smug smiles, to say nothing of the fact that those carrying instruments jingled and rattled and occasionally wailed in a most mysterious manner. There was, the Geggs felt, a certain amount of justice in disrupting this ceremony. These monthly rituals with the Welves were symbolic of their slavish treatment of the Geggs. Those Geggs who lived in Drevlin, mostly of the High Froman's own scrift, were the ones who consistently received the monthly mana, and though the High Froman insisted that all Geggs could come and share in it, he knew as well as the rest of Drevlin that the Geggs were bound to the Kixiwinsy, and that only a few, and then mostly clerks, could leave their servitude long enough to bask in the Welven eyes and share in the Welven mana. The Geggs, highly elated, marched to battle, their weapons jangling and ringing and wheezing in their hands. Marching along, Jara recalled the instructions she had given them. When the humans begin to sing, we swarm up the stairs, singing at the top of our lungs. Limbeck will make a speech, scattered applause. Then he and the gods who aren't will enter the ship. We want the ship, cried several Wups. No, you don't, answered Jara crossly. You want the reward. We're going to get the mana this time, all of it. Tumultuous applause. The High Froman won't come back with so much as a hand-knit doily. Limbeck is going to take the ship and sail away to Upper Worlds, where he will learn the truth and come back to proclaim it and free his people. No applause. After the promise of treasure, particularly knit doilies, currently much in demand, no one cared about truth. Jara understood this, and it saddened her, because she knew it would sadden Limbeck if he ever found out. Thinking about Limbeck, she had gradually moved forward through the crowd until she was walking right behind him. Her shawl thrown over her head so that no one would recognize her, she kept her eyes and her thoughts fixed on Limbeck. Jara wanted to go with him. At least she told herself she did. But she hadn't argued very hard, and had fallen silent completely when Limbeck told her she must stay behind and lead the movement in his absence. In reality, Jara was afraid. She had, it seemed, peeked through a crack and caught a glimpse of truth down there in the tunnels with Alfred. Truth wasn't something you went out and found. It was wide and vast and deep and unending, and all you could hope to see was a tiny part of it. And to see that part and to mistake it for the whole was to make of truth a lie. But Jara had promised. She couldn't let Limbeck down, not when this meant so much to him. And then there were her people, living a lie. Surely even a little of the truth would help them, not hurt them. The Geggs marching around Jara talked about what they would do with their share of the reward. Jara was silent, her eyes on Limbeck, wondering if she was hoping they'd succeed or fail. The High Froman reached the door at the base of the arm. Turning to the head clerk, he formally accepted a large key, nearly as big as his hand, which he used to open the opener. "Bring the prisoners," he called, and the coppers herded everyone forward. "Mind that dog," snapped the head clerk, kicking at the animal, sniffing with intense interest at his feet. Haplo called the dog to his side. The High Froman, the head clerk, several of the High Froman's personal guard, and the prisoners crowded into the lift aloft.
At the last moment, Limbeck halted in the door and turned, his eyes scanning the crowd. Catching sight of Jara, he looked at her long and earnestly. His expression was calm and resolute. He wasn't wearing his spectacles, but she had the feeling he could see her quite clearly. Jara, blinking back her tears, raised one hand in loving farewell. Her other hand, hidden beneath her cloak, clutched her weapon, a tambourine. Chapter 40. The Liftalofts, Drevlin, Low Realm.
"Captain," reported the lieutenant, peering at the ground below, "there are an unusual number of gegs waiting for us on the palm."
"They're not gegs, lieutenant," said the captain, spyglass to his eyes. "They appear from the looks of them to be human."
"Human?"
The lieutenant stared down at the palm. His hands itched to snatch the spyglass away from his captain and see for himself.
"What do you make of it, lieutenant?" inquired the captain.
"Trouble, I should think, sir. I've served on this run a number of years, and my father served before me, and I've never heard of humans being found on the low realm. I might suggest..."
The lieutenant caught himself and bit his tongue.
"Might suggest," repeated Captain Zancarel in a dangerous tone. "You might suggest to your captain? What might you suggest, lieutenant?"
"Nothing, sir. I was out of line."
"No, no, lieutenant, I insist," returned Zancarel with a glance at the gear.
"I might suggest that we do not dock until we find out what's going on."
This was a perfectly reasonable and logical suggestion, as Captain Zancarel well knew. But it would mean discussion with the Geggs, and Zancarel couldn't speak a word of Gegg. The lieutenant could. Captain Zancarel immediately came to the conclusion that this was just another trick of the lieutenant's to make a mockery of him. Captain Zancarel of the royal family in the eyes of the crew. The lieutenant had done so once already with his damn fool heroics. The captain decided he would see his soul in that small lapis and chalcedony inlaid box the gear carried with him at all times before he'd let that happen again.
"I didn't know you were quite so afraid of humans, lieutenant," responded the captain. "I cannot have a frightened man at my side going into what might be a dangerous situation. Report to your quarters, Lieutenant Botherin, and remain there for the duration of the voyage. I'll deal with the beasts."
Stunned silence settled over the bridge. No one knew where to look, and so avoided looking at anything. A charge of cowardice leveled against an elven officer meant death once they returned to Aristagon. The lieutenant could speak in his own defense at the tribunal, certainly, but his only defense would be to denounce his captain, a member of the royal family. Whom would the judges believe? Lieutenant Botherin's face was rigid, his almond eyes unblinking. A subdued midshipman said later that he'd seen dead men look more alive.
"As you command, sir."
The lieutenant turned on his heel and left the bridge.
"Cowardice, a thing I won't tolerate," intoned Captain Zancarel. "You men remember that?"
"Yes, sir,"
was the dazed and half-hearted response from men who had served under their lieutenant in several battles against both humans and rebel elves, and who knew, better than anyone, Botherin's courage.
"Pass the word for the ship's wizard," commanded the captain, staring through the spyglass at the small group gathered in the palm of the gigantic hand.
The word went out for the ship's wizard, who appeared immediately. Slightly flustered, he glanced around the group on the bridge as if endeavoring to ascertain if a rumor he'd heard on his way forward was true. No one looked at him. No one dared. No one needed to. Seeing the set faces and fixed eyes, the ship's wizard had his answer.
"We're facing an encounter with humans, Magicka."
Footnote. Magicka. Humans borrowed this word from the elven. End of footnote. The captain spoke in a bland voice as if nothing was amiss.
"I assume that all aboard have been issued whistles."
"Yes, Captain."
"All are familiar with their use?"
"I believe so, sir," replied the ship's wizard.
"The ship's last engagement was with a group of rebel elves who boarded us."
"I did not ask for a recitation of this vessel's war record, did I, Magicka?"
inquired Captain Zancarel.
"No, Captain."
The ship's wizard did not apologize. Unlike the crew, he was not bound to obey the orders of a ship's officer. Since only a wizard could possibly understand the proper use of his arcane art, each wizard was made responsible for the magic aboard ship. A captain dissatisfied with the work of his ship's wizard might bring the wizard up on charges, but the wizard would be tried by the Council of the Arcane, not by the Naval Tribunal. And in such a trial, it would not matter if the captain was a member of the royal family. Everyone knew who were the true rulers of Aristagon.
"The magic is functional," pursued the captain, "fully operational.
The crew members have but to put the whistles to their lips."
The ship's wizard drew himself up, stared down his nose at the captain. The Magus did not even add the customary, "sir."
his talent was being questioned. The gear, a wizard himself, could see that Zancarel had overstepped his authority.
"And you have done quite well, ship's wizard," intervened the gear in soft, oily tones. "I will be certain to pass on my commendation when we return home."
The ship's wizard sneered, as if it mattered to him what a gear thought of his work. Spending their lives running after spoiled brats in hopes of catching a soul, one might as well be a servant running after a pug dog in hopes of catching its droppings. "Will you join us on the bridge?" asked the captain politely, taking the hint from his gear. The ship's wizard had no intention of being anywhere else. This was his assigned station during battle, and though in this instance the captain was perfectly correct in making the invitation, the wizard chose to take it as an insult. "Of course," he stated in clipped and icy tones, and stalking over to the portals, glared out at the palm and its contingent of gegs and humans. "I believe we should make contact with the gegs and find out what is going on," he added. Did the ship's wizard know that this had been the lieutenant's suggestion? Did he know that this had precipitated the current crisis? The captain, thin cheeks flushing, glared at him. The ship's wizard, his back turned, did not notice. The captain opened his mouth, but catching sight of his gear shaking his head warningly, snapped it shut again. "Very well." Zancarel was making an obvious effort to contain his anger. Hearing a noise behind him, he whipped around and fixed a baleful eye on the crew, but everyone was apparently engrossed in his duties. The ship's wizard, bowing stiffly, took up a position in the prow, standing in front of the figurehead. Before him was a speaking cone carved out of the tooth of a Grenko. Footnote. Difficult to find, the Grenko are large and savage beasts, much prized for their teeth. Because of the animal's rarity, they are protected from hunting by strict elven law. Grenko shed their teeth annually. The teeth can be found strewn about the floor of any Grenko cave. The challenge in gathering the teeth lies in the fact that the Grenko leaves its cave only once yearly to go in search of a mate, and generally returns within a day's time span. Highly intelligent, with a keen sense of smell, Grenko will instantly attack anything found in their caves. End of footnote. Across one end of this tooth was stretched a diaphragm, made of the tear skin and magically enhanced to project a voice spoken into it. The sound boomed forth from the dragon's open mouth, and was quite impressive even to those who knew how it worked. The Gegs considered it a miracle. Bending near the cone, the wizard shouted out something in the uncouth language of the dwarves that sounds to elves like rocks being rattled in the bottom of a barrel. The captain maintained a rigid, stony-faced posture during the entire proceeding, expressing by his attitude that it was all errant nonsense. From down below came a great squawking bellow. The Gegs were answering. The elven wizard listened and replied. Turning, he faced the captain.
"It is all rather confusing. As near as I can make out, it seems that these humans have come to Drevelin and told the Gegs that we, Welves, are not gods but slavers who have been exploiting the dwarves. The Geg King asks that we accept the humans as his gift, and that in return we do something to re-establish ourselves as divine. He suggests," the wizard added, "doubling the usual amount of treasure."
The elf captain had regained his good humor.
"Human prisoners," he rubbed his hands in satisfaction. "What's more, prisoners who have obviously been attempting to sabotage our water supply. What a valuable find. I shall be decorated for this. Inform the Gegs that we will be happy to comply."
"What about the treasure?"
"Bah, they'll get the same as usual. What do they expect? We don't carry more."
"We could promise to send another ship," stated the wizard, frowning.
The captain's face flushed.
"If I made such an agreement, I'd be the laughing stock of the Navy. Risk a ship to deliver more treasure to these maggots? Ha!
Sir, nothing like this has ever before occurred. It appears to me that the humans have discovered a way to descend safely through the maelstrom and are endeavoring to disrupt Geg society to their own advantage. If the humans could manage to take control of our water supply..."
The wizard shook his head, mere words apparently being unable to convey the seriousness of the situation.
"Disrupt Geg society," Zancarel laughed. "I'll disrupt their society. I'll go down and take control of their stupid society. It's what we should have done long ago anyway. Tell the grubs we'll take the prisoners off their hands. That should be enough for them."
The ship's wizard glowered, but there was nothing he could do, for the moment at least. He could not authorize the sending of a treasure ship, and he dared not make a promise that he could not keep. That would only make matters worse. He could, however, report this immediately to the council, and advised that action be taken in regard to both the treasure and this imbecile captain. Speaking into the cone, the wizard couched the refusal in vague and obscure terms, intended to make it sound like an agreement unless anyone actually thought about it. Like most elves, he considered the Geg mental process to be tantamount to the sound of their language, rocks rattling around in a barrel. The warship glided down on widespread wings, looking fearsome and majestic. Elven crew members, wielding spars, stood out on the deck and carefully pulled and pushed the descending water pipe into place above the geyser. When alignment was achieved, the magic was activated. Encased in a conduit of blue light that beamed up from the ground, water shot forth and was sucked into the pipe and carried thousands of Menka above to the elves waiting for it on Aristogon. Once this process was begun, the elven ship had completed its primary task. When the holding tanks were full to capacity, the magical flow of water would cease, and the water pipe would be drawn back up. The water ship could now drop its treasure and return, or, as in this case, dock and spend a few moments impressing the Geggs. Chapter 41. The Liftalofts, Drevlin, Low Realm. The High Foeman didn't like it, any of it. He didn't like the fact that the prisoners were taking this much too docilely. He didn't like the words that the Welves were dropping on his head instead of more treasure. He didn't like the occasional musical note that emanated from the crowd below the palm. Watching the ship, the High Foeman thought he had never seen one move so slowly. He could hear the creaking of the cable drawing the gigantic wings inside the huge body, thus speeding the ship's descent. But it wasn't fast enough for Darrell Longshoreman. Once these gods and mad Limbeck were gone, life, he fondly hoped, would return to normal. If he could just get through the next few moments. The ship settled into place, its wings trimmed so that it maintained enough magic to keep it afloat in the air, hovering near the palm. The cargo bays opened, and the Mana fell onto the Geggs waiting below. A few of the Geggs began to clamor for it as it fell, those with keen eyes and good monetary sense latching onto the valuable pieces. But most of the Geggs ignored it. They remained standing, staring up at the top of the arm in tense, eager, jingling expectation. "Hurry, hurry," muttered the High Foeman. The opening of the hatch took an interminable length of time. The head clerk, oblivious of everything, was regarding the dragon ship with his usual insufferable expression of self-righteousness. Darrell longed to shove that expression, along with his teeth, down his brother-in-law's throat. "Here they come," the head clerk chattered excitedly. "Here they come." Whipping around, he fixed a stern eye upon the prisoners. "Mind you treat the Wells with respect. They, at least, are gods." "Oh, we will," piped up Bane with a sweet smile. "We're going to sing them a song." "Hush, Your Highness, please," remonstrated Alfred, laying a hand on Bane's shoulder. He added something inhuman that the High Foeman could not understand, and drew the boy back out of the way. Out of the way of what? And what was this nonsense about a song? The High Foeman didn't like it. He didn't like it one bit. The hatch opened, and the gangway slid out from the bulwarks and was fixed firmly to the fingertips of the palm. The elf captain emerged. Standing in the hatchway, surveying the objects before him, the elf appeared enormous in the ornately decorated iron suit that covered the thin body from toe to neck. His face could not be seen. A helmet shaped like the head of a dragon protected his head. Slung from his shoulder was a ceremonial sword encased in a jeweled scabbard that hung from a belt of frayed embroidered silk. Seeing that all appeared in order, the elf clunked ponderously across the gangway, the scabbard rattling against his thigh when he walked. He reached the fingers of the palm, stopped, and stood gazing about, the dragon's head helm lending him a stern and imperious air. The iron suit added an additional foot of height to the elf, who was already tall. He towered over the Geggs and over the humans as well. The helmet was so cunningly and fearsomely carved that even Geggs who had seen it before were awed. The head clerk sank to his knees, but the High Foeman was too nervous to be impressed. "No time for that now," snapped Darrell Longshoreman, reaching out to grab hold of his brother-in-law and get him back on his feet. "Coppers, bring the gods." "Damn," swore Hugh beneath his breath. "What is it?" Haplo leaned near. The captain had clanked his way onto the fingers. The head clerk had dropped to his knees, and the High Foeman was tugging at him. Limbeck was fumbling with a sheaf of papers. "The elf. See that thing he's wearing around his neck? It's a whistle." "So?" "Their wizards created it. Supposedly, when the elves blow into it, the sound it makes can magically negate the effects of the song."
"Which means the elves will fight."
"Yes,"
Hugh cursed himself.
"I knew warriors carried them, but not watership crews. And nothing to fight with except our bare hands and one dagger."
Nothing, and everything. Haplo needed no weapon. Rip the bandages from his hands, and by his magic alone he could destroy every elf on board that ship, or charm them to do his will, or send them into enchanted slumber. But he was forbidden to make use of his magic. The first sigil, whose fiery blaze he traced in the air, would proclaim him a patron, the ancient enemy who had long ago very nearly conquered the ancient world. "Death first, before you betray us. You have the discipline and the courage to make that choice.
You have the skill and the wits to make that choice unnecessary. The High Throwman was ordering the coppers to bring the guards. The coppers started toward Limbeck, who firmly and politely elbowed them out of the way. Stepping forward, he rustled his papers and drew in a deep breath.
Distinguished visitors from another realm, High Throwman, Head Clerk, my fellow Wups, it gives me great pleasure.
At least we'll die fighting, said Hugh. With elves, that's something. Haplo didn't have to die fighting. He didn't have to die at all. He hadn't expected it would be this frustrating. The squawky talk, designed to loudly transmit the blessings of the Welves, was now loudly transmitting Limbeck's speech.
Shut him up! Shouted the High Froman.
Throw up your hackles! No, that can't be right. Limbeck stopped. Peering at the paper, he took out his spectacles and put them over his ears.
Throw off your shackles! He shouted now that he could see.
The coppers surged forward, grabbing him by the arms.
Start singing, Haplo hissed. I've got an idea.
Hugh opened his mouth and began to boom out in a deep baritone the first notes of the song. Bane joined in, his shrill voice soaring above Hugh's in an ear-piercing shriek, heedless of tune, but never missing a word. Alfred's voice quavered, almost unheard. The man was pale as bleached bone with fear, and appeared on the verge of collapse. The hand that holds the ark and bridge, the fire that rails the tempered span. At the first note, the gags below let out a cheer, and grabbing their weapons began to toot and jingle and wheeze and sing with all their might. The coppers above heard the singing below and became flustered and distracted. The elven captain, hearing the notes of the dreaded song, grasped the whistle that hung from around his neck, raised the visor of the helm, and put the whistle to his lips. Haplo touched the dog lightly on the head, made a sweeping gesture with his hand, and pointed at the elf. Take him. All flame as heart, surmount the ridge. All noble paths are Elchman. Sleek and swift and silent as a thrown spear, the dog cut through the tangled crowd and leapt straight at the elf. The elven iron suit was ancient and archaic, designed primarily to intimidate, a remnant of olden days when such suits had to be worn as protection against the painful affliction known as the bends that struck those sailing swiftly up from the low realm to realms far above. By the time the elf captain saw the dog, it was airborne, aiming straight toward him. Instinctively, he tried to brace himself for the blow, but his body, encased in the clumsy armor, could not react fast enough. The dog hit him square in the chest, and the captain toppled over backward like a felled tree. Haplo was on the move with the dog, Hugh not far behind. There was no song on the patron's lips. The assassin was singing loudly enough for both. Fire in heart guides the will of flame set by hand.
Servers, unite! Shouted Limbeck, shaking off the annoying coppers.
Immersed in his speech, he paid no attention to the chaos around him.
I myself, ascending to the realms above, there to discover truth, the most valuable of treasures.
Treasures, echoed the squawky talk.
Treasure?
The gags standing below the palm looked at each other.
He said treasure. They're giving more away. Up there, up there!
The gags, still singing, surged toward the door in the base of the arm. A few coppers had been detailed to guard the entrance, but they were overwhelmed by the mob. One was later discovered lying comatose, a tambourine around his neck. The singing gags raced up the stairs. The hand that moves Elchman's song, the song of fire and heart and land. The first gags surged through the door at the top of the arm and dashed out onto the base of the golden palm. The palm's surface was slippery from the spray of the water shooting into the air. The gags slid and slithered and came precariously near, hurtling over the edge. Hastening forward, the coppers attempted to stop them, trying without success to herd them back down the stairs. Darrell Longshoreman stood in the center of the hooting, clanging crowd and watched in mute anger and outrage hundreds of years of peace and tranquility go up in song. Before Alfred could stop him, Bane raced excitedly after Hugh and Haplo. Caught up in the melee, Alfred struggled to try to catch the prince. Limbeck's spectacles were knocked off in the tussle. He managed to save them, but, getting knocked about in every direction, couldn't put them on. Blinking, bewildered, he stared around, unable to tell friend from foe, up from down. Seeing the gag's predicament, Alfred caught hold of Limbeck by the shoulder and dragged him toward the ship. The fire born of journey's end, the flame apart, a lightened call. The elf captain, flat on his back on the palm's fingers, struggled ineffectively with the dog, whose slashing teeth were trying to find their way between helm and breastplate. Reaching the gangway, Haplo glanced in some concern at an elven wizard hovering over the fallen elf. If the wizard used his magic, the patron would have little choice but to respond in kind. Perhaps in the confusion he could do it without being seen, but the wizard did not appear interested in fighting. He stood over the elf captain, watching keenly the battle with the dog. The wizard held in his hand a jeweled box. An eager expression lit his face. Keeping one eye on this strange wizard, Haplo knelt swiftly at the battling elf's side.
Making certainly kept clear of the dog's teeth, the patron slid his hand beneath the ironclad body, grappling for the sword. He grasped hold and pulled. The belt to which it was attached gave way, and the weapon was his. Haplo considered the sword an instant. The patron was loath to kill in this world, particularly elves. He was beginning to see how his lord could make future use of them. Turning, he tossed the weapon to Hugh. Sword in one hand, his dagger in the other, Hugh dashed across the gangway and through the hatch, singing as he ran. "Dog, here, to me," Haplo called. Immediately obeying the command, the dog bounded from the chest of the ironclad elf, leaving the captain floundering helplessly on his back like an overturned turtle. Waiting for the dog, Haplo managed to catch hold of Bane as the child hurtled past him. The prince was in a state of wild excitement, shrieking the song out at the top of his lungs.
"Let me go! I want to see the fight!"
"Where the hell's your keeper? Alfred!" Searching the crowd for the chamberlain, Haplo got a firm grip on the squirming, protesting boy and held onto him. Alfred was clumsily shepherding Limbeck through the chaos raging on the palm. The geg, struggling to keep his feet, was still pouring out his heart.
"And now, distinguished visitors from another realm, I would like to give to you the three tenets of Wup. First..."
The mob closed around Alfred and Limbeck. Releasing Bane, Haplo turned to the dog, pointed to the boy, and said, "Watch." The dog, grinning, sat down on his hind legs and fixed his eyes on Bane. Haplo left them. Bane stared at the dog.
"Good boy,"
he said, and turned to enter the hatch. Casually, the dog rose to his feet, sank his teeth into the rear end of His Highness's trousers, and held him fast. Haplo darted back across the gangway to Palm. He extricated Alfred and the speech-making Limbeck from the thick of the crowd and hustled them toward the ship. Several Wups, blowing their horns, surged after them, deafening any who tried to stop them. Haplo recognized Jara among them and tried to catch her eye, but she was bashing a copper with a wheezy wail and didn't see him. Despite the confusion, Haplo attempted to keep an ear attuned for fighting on board the ship. He heard nothing except Hugh's singing, however, not even the sound of blowing whistles. "Here, Chamberlain, the kid's your responsibility." Haplo freed Bane from the dog and thrust the kid toward a shaken Alfred. The patron and the dog raced across the gangway. Haplo assumed everyone else was following. Coming into the dark ship from the sunlight glaring off the golden palm, the patron was forced to pause and wait for his eyes to adjust. Behind him he heard Limbeck cry out, stumble, and fall to his knees, the sudden absence of light and the loss of his spectacles combining to effectively blind the geg. Haplo's vision cleared quickly. He saw now why he had heard no sounds of fighting. Hugh stood facing an elf with a naked sword in his hand. Behind the elf ranged the rest of the ship's crew, armed and waiting. The silver war robes of a ship's wizard caught the sunlight, gleaming brightly from where he stood behind the warriors. No one spoke. Hugh had quit singing. He watched the elf narrowly, waiting for the attack.
"The sullen walk, the flickering aim,"
Bane trilled the words, his voice loud and jarring. The elf's gaze slid toward the child. The hand grasping the sword shivered slightly, and his tongue flicked over dry lips. The other elves ranged behind him were seemingly awaiting his orders, but they kept their eyes fixed on him as their leader. Haplo swiveled about. "Sing, damn it!" he shouted, and Alfred, jolted into action, raised his voice, a piping tenor. Limbeck was shuffling through his papers, trying to find the place where he'd left off. There was Jara coming across the gangplank, more Wups behind her, all gleeful and eager for treasure. Haplo signaled frantically, and finally she saw him. "Keep away," he motioned, mouthing the words at the same time. "Keep away!" Jara halted her troop, and they obediently, and a few literally, fell back at her command. The gegs craned their heads to see, watching intently to make certain no one got a glass bead ahead of them. "Fire leads again from futures all." The singing was louder now, Alfred's voice stronger, carrying the tune, Bane growing hoarse but never flagging. Certain now the gegs would not interfere, Haplo turned from them to Hugh and the elf. Holding the same positions, swords raised, each watched the other warily.
"We mean you no harm," said Hugh in elven.
The elf raised a delicate eyebrow, glanced around at his armed crew, who outnumbered them 20-1.
"No kidding," replied the elf.
But the hand knew something of the ways of elves, apparently, for he continued without pause, speaking their language fluently.
"We've been stranded down here. We want to escape. We're bound for the High Realm."
The elf sneered.
"You're lying, human. The High Realm is banned, ringed round by magical protection." "Not to us. They'll let us pass," said Hugh. "This child," he pointed at Bane, "is the son of a Mysteriarch. He'll..."
Limbeck found his place.
"Distinguished visitors from another realm."
From outside came a clunking and clattering of iron.
"The whistles.
Use the whistles, you fools!"
Two whistles screeched, the elf captain's and that of the wizard holding the box. The dog growled, its ears pricked, its hackles bristled. Haplo stroked the animal reassuringly, but it wouldn't be calmed and began to howl in pain. The clunking noise and the whistling grew louder. A shadow appeared in the hatchway, blotting out the sunlight. Alfred shrank back, pulling Bane behind him. Limbeck was reading his speech and didn't see the captain. An iron-clad arm shoved the gag roughly aside, knocking him into a bulkhead. The elf stood in the hatchway, blasting on his whistle. He had removed the helm. The eyes glaring at his crew were red with rage. He took the whistle from his lips long enough to shout savagely, "Do as I command, damn you, Lieutenant!" The wizard, box in hand, hovered at his charger's elbow. The elf facing Hugh lifted the whistle with a hand that seemed to move of its own accord. The lieutenant's eyes went from his captain to Hugh and back to the captain again. The rest of the crew either lifted the whistles or toyed with them. A few blew tentative bleeps. Hugh didn't understand what was going on, but he guessed that victory hung upon a note, so to speak, and so began to sing hoarsely. Haplo joined in, the captain blasted away on the whistle, the dog howled in pain, and everyone, including Limbeck, came out strong on the last two verses, "The arc and bridge are thoughts and heart, the span a life, the ridge a part." The lieutenant's hand moved and grasped the whistle. Haplo, marking an elven warrior near the officer, tensed, ready to jump the man and try to wrest away his weapon. But the lieutenant did not put the whistle to his lips. He gave the thong on which it hung a vicious jerk, broke it, and hurled it to the deck. There was ragged cheering among the elven crew, and many, including the ship's wizard, followed their lieutenant's example. The captain's face flushed crimson with rage. Blotches of white stood out on his thin cheeks. Foam flecked his lips.
"Traitors! Traitors led by a coward! Weesham, you are my witness. They are mutineers, filthy rebels, and when we get back..."
"We're not going back, Captain," said the lieutenant, standing straight and tall, his gray eyes cool. "Stop that singing," he added.
Hugh had only a vague idea of what was going on. Apparently, they'd stumbled across some sort of private feud among the elves. But he was quick to recognize that it could turn to their advantage, and he made a motion with his hand. Everyone hushed, Alfred ordering Bane twice to keep silent, and finally clapping his hand over the boy's mouth.
"I told you this man was a coward," the captain addressed the crew. "He hasn't the guts to fight these beasts. Get me out of this thing."
The elf captain could not move in the iron suit. His gear laid a hand upon the armor and spoke a word. The iron melted away. Bounding forward, the elf captain put his hand to his side, only to discover his sword was gone. He found it almost immediately. Hugh was pointing it at his throat.
"No, human," cried the lieutenant, moving to block Hugh. "This is my battle. Twice, Captain, you have called me coward, and I could not defend my honor. Now you can no longer hide behind your rank."
"You say that very bravely, Lieutenant, considering that you are armed and I am not."
The lieutenant turned to Hugh.
"As you can see, human, this is an affair of honor. I am told you humans understand such things. I ask that you give the captain his sword. That leaves you weaponless, of course, but you didn't have much chance anyway, being one against so many. If I live, I pledge myself to assist you. If I fall, then you must take your chances as before."
Hugh considered the odds, then, shrugging, handed over the sword. The two elves squared off, falling into fighting stance. The crew was intent on watching the battle between their captain and his lieutenant. Hugh edged his way near one of them, and Haplo guessed that the assassin wouldn't be weaponless for long. The patron had his own worries. He had been keeping his eye on the riot raging outside the ship, and saw that the Wups, having defeated the coppers, were blood-crazed and searching for trouble. Should the gags board the ship, the elves would think it was an all-out attack, forget their own differences, and fight back. Already Haplo could see the gags pointing at the ship, yammering about treasure. Sword clashed against sword. The captain and lieutenant thrust and parried. The elf wizard watched eagerly, clutching the inlaid box he held to his breast. Moving swiftly but smoothly, hoping to attract as little attention as possible, Haplo made his way over to the hatch. The dog trotted along at his heels. Jara stood on the gangway, her hands grasping a broken tambourine, her eyes fixed on Limbeck. Undaunted, the Geg had climbed to his feet, adjusted his spectacles, found his place, and resumed speaking.
"A better life for everyone!"
Behind Jara, the Gegs were rallying, urging each other to go into the ship and grab the spoils of war. Haplo found the mechanism for raising and lowering the gangplank, and quickly studied it to understand how it operated. His only problem now was the female Geg.
"Jara!" Haplo cried, waving his hand. "Get off the plank! I'm going to raise it! We've got to leave now!"
"Limbeck!"
Jara's voice was inaudible, but he understood the movement of her lips.
"I'll take care of him and bring him back to you safely, I promise."
That was an easy promise to make. Once Limbeck was properly molded, he would be ready to lead the Gegs and develop them into a united fighting force, an army willing to lay down their lives for the Lord of the Nexus. Jara took a step forward. Haplo didn't want her. He didn't trust her. Something had changed her. Alfred had changed her.
She wasn't the same fiery revolutionary she'd been before she went off with him. That man, meek and inoffensive as he seemed, bore watching. By this time the Geggs had goaded each other to action and were marching unimpeded toward the ship. Behind him, Haplo could hear the duel between the two elves rage on unabated. He set the mechanism, prepared to raise the gangway. Jara would slip and fall to her death. It would look like an accident. The Geggs would blame it on the elves. He put his hand on the mechanism, ready to activate it, when he saw the dog dash past him, running across the plank. "Dog, get back here!" But either the animal was ignoring him, or in the midst of the singing and the sword clashing, it couldn't hear him. Frustrated, Haplo let go of the mechanism and started out onto the gangway after the animal. The dog had latched on to the sleeve of Jara's blouse and was tugging her off the plank, herding her in the direction of the palm. Jara, distracted, looked down at the dog, and as she did so, saw her people advancing on the ship. "Jara," cried Haplo, "turn them back! The wells will kill them! They'll kill all of us if you attack!" She looked back at him, then at Limbeck. "It's up to you, Jara," Haplo shouted. "You're their leader now." The dog had loosed its hold and was gazing up at her, its eyes bright, its tail wagging. "Goodbye, Limbeck," whispered Jara. Leaning down, she gave the dog a fierce hug, then turned and, shoulders squared, stepped off the gangway onto the fingers of the palm. Facing the Geggs, she raised her hands, and they halted. "More treasure is being dropped. You must all go down below. There's nothing up here." "Below? It's being dropped below?" Hastily, the Geggs whirled around and began to push and shove, trying to reach the stairs. "Get in here, dog," Haplo ordered. The animal gambolled across the deck, its tongue lolling out of its mouth in an irrepressible grin of triumph. "Proud of yourself, huh?" Haplo said, releasing the mechanism and pulling on the ropes, drawing up the gangplank as swiftly as possible. He heard Jara's voice raised in command, heard the Geggs shout in support. The gangway slid inside. Closing the hatch, Haplo sealed it tight. The Geggs could no longer be seen or heard. "Disobedient mutt, I should have you skinned," muttered Haplo, fondling the dog's silky ears. Raising his voice above the clashing of steel, Limbeck carried on, "And in conclusion, I would like to say..." Chapter 42. The Liftalofts, Drevlin, Low Realm. Haplo turned from the hatch in time to see the lieutenant thrust his sword through the elf captain's body. The lieutenant yanked his weapon free, and the captain slid to the deck. The crew was silent, no sound of either cheering or lamenting. The lieutenant, his face cold and impassive, stood back to allow the wizard room to kneel beside the dying elf. Haplo assumed that this wizard, who had been in attendance upon the captain, was a healer. The patron was surprised, therefore, to see the wizard make no gestures toward helping the dying. He held the inlaid box he carried up to the captain's lips. "Speak the words," the gear hissed. The captain made some attempt, but blood gushed out of his mouth. The wizard appeared angry, and, propping up the elf's head, forced the rapidly dimming eyes to look at the box. "Speak the words. It is your duty to your people." Slowly, with an obvious effort, the elf gasped out words that were to Haplo unintelligible. The captain sank back, lifeless. The wizard snapped the box shut and, glancing suspiciously at the other elves, guarded it jealously, as if he had just locked away some rare and priceless jewel. "You dare not harm me," he whined. "I am a Wisham, protected by law. A curse will follow you all your days if you prevent me from carrying out my sacred task." "I have no intention of harming you," said the lieutenant, his lip curled in scorn. "Although what possible use the soul of that wretch can be to our people is best known to yourselves. Still, he died with honor, if he did not live with it. Perhaps that counts for something." Reaching down, he picked up the dead elf's sword, and turning, handed it, hilt first, to Hugh. "Thank you, human. And you," the elf glanced at Haplo. "I saw the peril we faced from the Geggs. Perhaps when we have leisure to discuss such things, you can explain to me what is going on in Drevlin. Now we must prepare to swiftly take our leave." The elf turned back to Hugh. "What you said about the High Realm, is that true?" "Yes." Hugh took the scabbard off the dead elf, thrust the sword into it. "The boy," he jerked a thumb at Bane, who was standing mute, staring curiously at the corpse, "is the son of one Sinistrad, a Mysteriarch." "How came such a child to be in your care?" The elf was looking at Bane thoughtfully. Bane, his pale face almost translucent, caught the elf's gaze. Meeting the gray eyes, he smiled sweetly, bravely, and made a grave and graceful bow. The lieutenant was charmed. Hugh's face darkened. "Never mind, it's not your affair. We were attempting to reach the High Realm when our ship was attacked by your people. We fought them off, but my ship was damaged and fell into the maelstrom." "Your ship? Humans do not fly dragon ships. Humans named Hugh the Hand fly what they please." The elves murmured, the first sounds they had made since the commencement of the duel. The lieutenant nodded.
I see. That explains much. Withdrawing a lace-edged piece of cloth from the pocket of his uniform, the elf used it to wipe blood from his sword blade, then slid the weapon into its sheath. You are known to be a human of honor. Rather peculiar honor, but honor nonetheless. If you will excuse me, humans, I have duties to perform now that I am captain of this vessel. Midshipman Ilf will show you to quarters.
So might slaves be dismissed from the presence of the master, Haplo thought. The elf has chosen to side with us, but he has no love for us, and apparently little respect. The elven midshipman motioned them to follow him. Limbeck was kneeling beside the body of the dead elf.
I was right, he said when he felt Haplo's hand on his shoulder. They're not gods.
No, said Haplo, they're not. There are no gods in this world, as I've told you. Limbeck glanced about, looking very much as if he had lost something and hadn't the vaguest idea where to begin searching for it.
Do you know, he said after a moment, I'm almost sorry.
Following the midshipman off the bridge, Haplo heard one of the elves ask, What do we do with the body, Lieutenant? Throw it overboard? No, said the lieutenant. He was an officer, and his remains will be treated with respect. Place the body in the hold. We will stop in the mid-realm and deposit it and the gear with it. And from now on, mate, you will address me as captain. The elf was moving swiftly to command his crew's respect, knowing that he must knit up the threads of discipline he himself had unraveled. Haplo awarded the elf silent commendation and accompanied the others below. The young elf placed them in what Hugh said was the shipboard equivalent of a dungeon. The brig was bare and cheerless. There were hooks on the walls where hammocks could be slung up at night for sleeping. During the day, they were stowed away to leave enough space to move about. Small portholes provided a view of outside. Having informed them that he would return with food and water once the ship was safely through the maelstrom, the midshipman shut the door and they heard the bolt slide home.
We're prisoners, cried Bane.
Hugh settled himself, crouching on his haunches, his back against a bulkhead. He appeared to be in a bad mood. Drawing his pipe out of his pocket, he clamped it between his teeth.
You want to see prisoners? Go take a look at the humans working below deck. They're the reason he's keeping us locked up. We could take over this ship if we freed the slaves, and he knows it.
Then let's do it,
said Bane, his face flushed with excitement.
Hugh glowered at him. You think you can fly this ship, Your Highness? Maybe like you flew mine, huh?
Bane flushed in anger. Hand clutching the feather, the child swallowed his rage and marched across deck to glare out the portholes.
And you trust him? Alfred inquired somewhat anxiously. This elf?
No more than he trusts me.
Hugh sucked moodily on the empty pipe. So are they converted, or whatever happens to elves when they hear that song? Asked Haplo.
Converted? Hugh shook his head. I don't think so. Elves truly affected by that song lose all awareness of their surroundings. It's as if they've been transported to another world. This elf's doing what he's doing for himself. The lure of the reputed wealth of the High Realm, and the fact that no elves have ever dared...